What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyers in the house.
And we welcome you in Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, July 14th, 2016. Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside, the Legal Eagles in studio. My name is Sam Panionovich. From Chicago to Los Angeles we go. Respected attorney Carl Douglas with us now on Legal Face-Off. Good morning. How are you?
Thanks so much, man.
Carl, thanks for joining us. You were on the Dream Team. You're the second Dream Teamer that we've had on. We've had Alan Dershowitz, who's a regular guest on Legal Face-Off. We all were fascinated by both the movie and the recent documentary, O.J. Made in America, in which you're featured prominently. And I thought, you know, we learned a lot from the trial from you in that movie. So I want to ask you, what was the one thing you think either the documentary or the film got wrong, or that you would have liked to explain in further detail? Is there anything that you think, you know, maybe wasn't portrayed in either the show on FX or the documentary properly?
That's an interesting question, Richard. The one thing in the FX series that they got wrong was there was a courtroom scene in episode 5 of the 10, I think it was, that had an interchange in court, and then the character playing William Hodgman had a heart attack in the courtroom there and fell off in the courtroom. I remember that occasion because he was fighting with me before he got sick, and I remember that he was actually upstairs in his office. He had a heart pang of some kind, angina, I think it was called, and he was taken away by ambulance from his office. But there was not the dramatic presentation in the courtroom itself as was in the series.
Interesting. Let's jump into the documentary a little bit. So you were a younger attorney practicing in Los Angeles at the time. You worked with Johnny Cochran. How did you first get the call that you'd be representing, you know, the most famous murder defendant in history? What was that initial, you know, call or discussion like for you personally?
Well, Richard, it was funny because initially Johnny Cochran was working as one of the commentators for NBC News, doing national commentary on the preliminary hearing. And he was talking about how monumentally steep the hurdle was for O.J. to overcome. I remember then, though, that he got a call from one of O.J.'s colleagues, and then O.J. called. And I remember myself and other staff lawyers basically having our ear pressed against the wall to his office, trying to overhear the conversations between he and O.J. because we were very, very excited at the possibility of our firm coming involved in that case.
Oh, my God, that's amazing. To the extent that you could talk about this kind of stuff, what was OJ's demeanor like as the trial progressed? I mean, we all watched it, you know, I mean, I remember where I was during the entire trial, and we've seen some of it in the documentary, and I thought the documentary did an amazing job, you know, giving us some inside detail about some of the conversations that were going on. But, you know, you were close to OJ during the trial. What was his demeanor like as the trial was progressing?
It's funny, Rich, because I've been a lawyer for 36 years. I've had probably more than 100 trials, but O.J. was probably one of the most engaged and intelligent clients that I had ever had. He was particularly adept at trying to present a certain image of himself or his team in a certain way, because he was one of the first pitchmen, someone who was able to create a marketable persona basically out of whole cloth. He had developed a really strong sense of presentation, how to act, how to look, how to stand, how to react. And so he was very much engaged throughout the trial in trying to make sure that his lawyers reflected the image that he thought best to convey.
Walk us through, Carl, the documentary, and in fact the FX series for that matter, spend some time on the jury visit to the estate. And you spoke very openly, and I thought, you know, really honestly about what the defense team did to alter the appearance of the home. I mean, you were very, you know, clear in the documentary about what you did. Could you sort of walk us through the mindset, who came up with that idea, and how the jury reacted to that from you being there at the time?
You got to understand, Rich, that as an advocate, what I am trying to do is to connect with my jury as best as I can. You also have to understand that in any sort of a trial, it is an adversarial prospect. I'm trying to win. There is someone on the other side that is also trying to win. There's a judge in the middle that is calling balls and strikes, if you will. There was an occasion that there was going to be a jury view at O.J.'s home. O.J.'s home was not a crime scene. The crime scene happened at Bundy. The visit there took place in February of 1995, a full 8 months after the death. And we wanted to show a couple of things. One, that O.J.'s home was majestic, and it was not the kind of thing that he would sacrifice all of that for in a fit of angry rage. But also, there was a very white carpet going from the front door all the way up to the second level, and there were no blood spatter or prints on that carpet, and we thought it was important for the jury to see that. On the wall, though, there were these pictures, and Johnny Cochran, as the lead lawyer, wanted to make the home as comfortable for the strangers who would visit as he could. There was a lot of emphasis placed on just the racial makeup of the picture that we changed. We didn't make a picture. There were pictures of O.J. and his family and his friends, but there were some pictures that we thought were inappropriate, Rich. For example, I remember a picture of his beautiful girlfriend, Paula Barbieri. She was a model, and there was an artistic nude that was near his bedside. And we did not think a nude photograph would be the proper photograph for strangers to come visit. So we changed that picture. I remember another picture of O.J. blowing out candles on a gagged birthday cake. And the candles were placed strategically in the cake, and the cake was the portrayal of a woman's body laying on her back. So you can imagine where the two candles were placed. We did not, and all his buddies were around laughing as he was blowing out those candles. That was a picture that we did not think a predominantly female jury would welcome, and so we changed those pictures as well. But it was all designed to make the environment more conducive to our jury. It wasn't a crime scene, and when you think about it, that visit took place in February, before the Furman tapes, before the glove demonstration. So anyone were to suggest that the verdict 7 months later was in any way based on that one visit, I would dispute dramatically.
Carl Douglas from the Douglas Law Firm, former Los Angeles Trial Attorney of the Year. You've represented many high-level celebrities, including Michael Jackson, Jamie Foxx. Walk us through what that year is like for someone who's a member of the Dream Team that, you know, I assume you were devoting every free minute of your time. I've got a trial starting next week, and my last couple of weeks have been crazy. Nothing compared to the year that you spent on this case. Could you handle any other cases while this was going on? Were you, you know, completely useless to your family? What was that year like?
Rich, we spent 16 months working on one case, 9 months in trial. In trials, as you know, though it might be a 7 or 8 hour trial day, there's still extra hours preparing and digesting and getting ready for the next day. So there were 10, 12, even 14 hour days, 6.5 days a week. I would tend to take off at least Sunday and spend it with my young son, who was 3 at the time. And it's funny, man, I remember one of the early Sundays, he and I were in a mall, and we did not realize that the television trial was being saturated on TVs all across the Southland there on CNN, and every local station in Los Angeles had it then. And I recall distinctly one of the first Sundays I was in a mall in near my house, and someone came up to me and said, "Hey, you're that lawyer." And little did I know then what a tremendous impact the image of television has all across America. It was mind-numbing to think about it, that everything that you did for 9 months was going to be scrutinized and analyzed by lawyers watching your every move. Tremendously stressful, but it was an experience, man, that I will take to my grave and will relish for my last breath on this earth.
Carl, last thing, and we really appreciate your time here on Legal Face-Off. Gun violence continues to plague this country. If you had your druthers, what's the first step to fixing this issue, if there even is one?
Gee, Jason, that's a great question, man, because particularly the things that have gone on across our nation over the past week. Indeed, with you being in Chicago, you know firsthand what a tragic implication gun violence has across all of our communities. And it starts, man, with continuing the conversations and with better training. One thing that virtually every police department across this nation requires before an officer uses deadly force is that it be the imminent need, the immediate need of that force, and that there be no other reasonable alternatives available. And all too often, we see officers exercising that ultimate use of force all too quickly. Often, I suggest, out of just abject fear. Fear is what made the officer in Minnesota shoot Philando Castile and then frozen-like just stand there holding his gun while the man bled to death. Fear, I suggest, is what caused the officers in Baton Rouge to strike and to shoot Alton Sterling several times because he was down on the ground and someone may have seen something protruding from his pocket. So there needs to be great training, but there needs to be more shows like yours that continues to put this issue front and center for all Americans to have this conversation.
Carl, one last question. One last question about the OJ doc, if we can. One of my favorite parts is when you talk about the call you placed to Johnny Cochran, who, you know, thought that you had weeks off when the jury was deliberating, and you talk about calling Johnny, who's in Napa with his wife, taking, you know, a well-deserved time off after spending, you know, 16 months on trial, and you tell him the jury's back, get back here as soon as possible. What? How shocked were you that the jury took, what, 3.5 hours to deliberate?
Oh, it's funny, man, because
And the follow-up to that is, did you think that 3.5 hours was good news or bad news for you?
Okay, well, first, Richard, that was Johnny Cochran's birthday, October the 2nd. So he and his wife had stolen a day away up to the wine country to spend the day. And when I called him, he had to take the call in a closet so that no one could listen. And he was shocked when he heard that there was a verdict. But I had been there the day before, and the jury had had a question and had wanted to have some testimony reread. And while they were deliberating, after the testimony had been reread, we discovered that the clerk had failed to turn the verdict forms, 5 physical pieces of paper, back into the jury for them to vote on and to take votes. And they then buzzed 3 buzzes, which in California in those days reflected having a verdict, like 5 minutes after those sheets had been submitted to them. I knew then, guys, that it would take several different votes of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, manslaughter, etc., for them to vote guilty. But quicker votes, shorter votes, not guilty on 1, not guilty on 2, for them to vote not guilty. So I was strongly confident after they buzzed that it was going to be a not guilty verdict. And it's funny, because that evening I went first, I talked to OJ in the lockup and explained my thoughts to him as he was pacing back and forth anxiously, worrying in the lockup. But then when I went home, each of the 9 lawyers on the defense team called me that night to get my spin of what happened. and I told them all I thought it was a not guilty. All lawyers called me but one. That one lawyer was Bob Shapiro, who never bothered to call. And we now know why.
We certainly do. He's on Twitter at CEDESQ from the Douglas Hicks Law Firm, DouglasHicksLaw.com. Carl Douglas, thank you so much for your time.
Jason, my pleasure, man. Please have me back. I'm a Northwestern grad. I love Chicago.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back, Legal Face-Off. We are on Facebook at Legal Face-Off, Twitter at The Legal Face-Off. Of course, we're on iTunes. You can always rate, review, and share with a friend. Plenty to get to today. We're going to talk O.J. because what would Legal Face-Off be without talking about O.J. Simpson? We will talk about Justice Ginsburg comments on Donald Trump, Avvo, and then the grab bag is full of stuff. Netflix passwords, why you probably shouldn't share them, liability with Tesla and their autopilot, plus Pokemon Go. The story never ends as we welcome to the phone. This is where we play lawyers meet the professors. Professor Ronald Rotunda, professor of law at Chapman University School of Law, and professor of law Louis Ferrelli from Stetson University, also an author. The book is Disqualifying the High Court, Supreme Court Recusal, and the Constitution. Gentlemen, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. You know, so breaking news this week, and in fact today, surrounds the notorious RBG, our favorite justice on this show, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, came out earlier in the week in a couple of different interviews and was very critical of presumptive, in a couple of days, soon-to-be Republican nominee for president, Donald Trump. She said that he was a faker. She said, I can't imagine what this place would be. I can't imagine what the country would be with Donald Trump as our president. She said, for the country, it could be 4 years. For the court, it could be. I don't even want to contemplate that. So, Professor Varela, you're an expert in Supreme Court recusals. You wrote the book on that. Does this mean that Justice Ginsburg would have to recuse herself from any case involving or any case if Trump became president?
I think the short answer is no, and that's based primarily on the fact that the Supreme Court is inherently different from the lower federal courts.
Can you explain that for our listeners?
Happy to. For about 250 years, the justices have been recusing themselves from cases, but they've always done it on a set of conditions that are sort of broader than what we consider federal recusal law proper in this country, the statute passed by Congress first in 1792 and updated and amended to the present day. Supreme Court justices can't be replaced. So when they make a decision to recuse themselves, they have more than one consideration in mind. They have the ethical question about whether it's fair and impartial to decide a case when you've criticized one of the parties, and the feature of making sure the court can do its job. If we lose too many justices, or we leave ourselves with an even number of justices, as we've seen recently after Justice Scalia's passing, we run the risk of the court not being able to fulfill its function. That doesn't mean Justice Ginsburg should not recuse if she chooses to. It just means that it's a more complicated question for the Supreme Court than it would be for other courts, because there's more constitutional responsibilities in jeopardized at the court, at the Supreme Court, when justice recuses himself.
All right. And Professors Varela and Rotunda, this is a question for both of you. Why is it unprecedented, or why is it is it really unprecedented for a Supreme Court justice to make a political comment like that?
Yeah, this is Ron Rotunda. I'd like to comment on Professor Varela's earlier statement, because there's not a word of it I agree with. There is no rule that says Supreme Court justices have some duty to sit in a case. In fact, there's a statute that covers it. If the majority of the justices have to recuse themselves, it goes to another circuit. I forget which one. It goes to a circuit, another court of appeals. I mean, they've taken care of all of that. Secondly, it would be mind-boggling to think that after Justice Ginsburg calls Trump a faker, that she'd have to move to New Zealand if he came, that basically she endorses Clinton and tells people to vote against Trump, that she could decide, for example, an issue like Bush v. Gore, a dispute about counting votes to see who's going to be the next president.
All right, but what you mentioned Bush v. Gore, and listen, we love anytime any of our guests disagree because it's called Legal Face-Off. But if there was a Bush v. Gore, let's say it was Trump v. Clinton here in a few months, and Justice Ginsburg was called upon to rule on, you know, a similar question, how could she possibly do that when she's already said in public she doesn't want Trump to be president? Now, we'll say that breaking today is her statement in which she apologizes for criticizing Trump. She said,
never uses the word apologize.
Well, she said, yeah, I was just about to read her statement. She said, on reflection, my recent remarks were ill-advised, and I regret making them, so maybe regret, not apology. She says, judges should avoid commenting on a candidate for public office. But how do you put that toothpaste back in the tube? If I'm Trump, and this is a Trump v. Clinton, you know, Supreme Court case, how do you possibly let her decide on that? Professor Rotunda?
I don't think she was going to decide that she. I think she would recuse herself. I mean, it is true that if she refuses to recuse herself, there may be nothing short of impeachment to get rid of her, because the nice thing about being on the Supreme Court is there's no appeal from the court except the law reviews. But that's not an excuse to be lawless. For example, I can see Hillary Clinton having a photograph in a commercial with Ginsburg's face, and the voiceover reads things that Ginsburg said, that is, Trump's a faker, which he said the day after her New York Times publication, that you have to move to New Zealand if she comes. She promises, basically, we will get reversed the Second Amendment cases. You don't have a right to protect yourself with a handgun. We will get Citizens United reversed. So when individuals decide to pool the resources and incorporate, they cannot speak about political issues. I mean, those are other cases she ought to recuse herself from, because what she did is really step in it, and and she's politicized the court, and it was very unfortunate for the court. And if she lives to be 200 years old, it will be a line in her obituary, which she did yesterday and the day before.
Hey, Professor Varelli, should or shouldn't Supreme Court justices stay out of politics while they're on the bench?
Well, I agree with Justice Ginsburg's most recent statement that it was probably regrettable that she said it. The question about recusal, though, I think is more complicated. And, of course, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Professor Rotunda, as we all do. I just disagree with him. And only in this way. The law of recusal that applies to the justices and has since 1948, in my view, and this is my thesis of my book, is unconstitutional for separation of powers reasons, because Congress can't tell the court how to compose itself when it's deciding a case. That's up to the justices, for the simple reason that if Congress were in charge, you could have a case where all nine justices recuse themselves and the court can't do its job. A circuit court filling that gap isn't the same, because that precedent isn't nationally binding and doesn't do what the Constitution assigns the court the power to do in Article 3. So I just think the issue is more complicated. If Justice Ginsburg faced a Bush v. Gore, I think there are very strong arguments for recusal. I wouldn't argue that she must sit. But I do think it's fair, and it's absolutely consistent with the court's historical practice for almost 50 years, for her to sit for institutional reasons, in other words, to let the court do its job with an odd number of justices to decide an important issue. In a Bush v. Gore context, the issue before the court would certainly not be, is Trump a fit president? That doesn't mean she wouldn't have biases and that she didn't express them, but she wouldn't have announced her position in that case ahead of time, where, for example, Justice Alito, who shook his head at the State of the Union and said no in response to a criticism by President Obama of the case, I think did show his hand. And I would suggest that he's got the same latitude in recusal that Justice Ginsburg would, specifically because he's a Supreme Court justice. Excuse me.
Why didn't Justice O'Connor recuse herself from Bush v. Gore when she famously made a statement that seemingly was in favor of a Bush presidency? She said, this is terrible. at an election night watch party after, you know, Florida was prematurely called for Al Gore. Many argue that she should have recused herself from Bush v. Gore. Should she have?
And I understand the argument, and I think my answer would be the same. It's that because none of her predecessors in the previous 200 years would have recused themselves. And that's because the court has more things on its mind when it decides a case like that than simply, and I'm not trivializing the ethical questions, I certainly don't mean to be if I sound like I am, but they have other considerations, like if we tie in Bush v. Gore, that means the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has decided the election. That is a much sort of less satisfying and constitutionally problematic decision than the Supreme Court deciding the case. Justices have considered this without question since Chief Justice John Marshall at the beginning of the court. Chief Justice Stone in the 40s recused himself from a case, and then when it turned out the court wasn't going to be able to meet the quorum requirements, he unrecused himself in the same case. No indication that the facts changed. He unrecused himself in order to solve the institutional problem of the court needing to be able to do its job in that. That was a case about the constitutionality of a regulation. So there's an unbroken history of the justices doing recusal differently for themselves than for everybody else. That has constitutional meaning in my mind, and that's my position in the book.
Well, first of all, the fact that the court has an odd number of justices says nothing about recusal. Or excuse me, has an even number of justices now because of Scalia's death. Says nothing about recusal. The original court had 6 justices. The number of justices on the court varies because of a federal statute. It's been at 9 since shortly after the Civil War. Frankly, I think it's good to have an even number of justices. I keep it at 8 or 10. So you need a supermajority rather than a bare majority to invalidate statutes that govern the whole nation. The argument that the federal recusal statute is unconstitutional is one that finds no support in the precedents. Now, I suppose the court could do that. You know, they can do whatever they want. And Ginsburg said she will when she gets this the Hillary appointee. But the court has never suggested the recusal statute, the disqualification statute, is unconstitutional. It's applied it for ever since there's been such a statute. There's a special statute requiring Justice Kagan, that is the only one in this category, to recuse herself in any case, not only when she was on the brief as Solicitor General, but she gave an opinion on or talked about, even though her name is on the brief. I pointed that out at her hearings, and then she broadened her disqualification to follow the statute. There are all kinds of ways that the Congress and the President affect the court. Delaying appointment of justices is one of the things they are doing right now. So I don't think the statute's unconstitutional. Chief Justice Roberts, in his State of the Federal Judiciary report a few years ago, said he wants to assure everyone that the justices follow the same general principles, I'm quoting now, the same general principles respecting recusal as other federal judges. Now, he says that, but apparently Justice Ginsburg didn't get the memo.
Professor,
can I respond
yeah, of
to
course.
That briefly?
I was going to ask you to respond.
In his 2011 year-end report, Chief Justice Roberts says specifically, and I apologize, I don't have it in front of me, but he says that the constitutionality or Congress's ability to require recusal for the justices is an open question. Justice Kennedy said that in testimony before the court. Before Congress. Justices Breyer and Scalia have both indicated in testimony before Congress, and this is all in the last 5 to 10 years, that they think there are problems with the recusal statute and with the code of ethics, code of conduct of the United States judges being applied to the court because the court is different. So I would take issue with the idea that there is no precedent suggesting it is unconstitutional. I think all of the court's actual actions have indicated that they don't believe it's constitutional, and they've never had to rule on it because justices make their own decisions, and those decisions are unreviewable. And that has been true since 1789 and, in fact, much farther back into the English common law. So we don't have the court saying that it is unconstitutional, and I think that's because they don't want to be the ones to seem like the aggressor in protecting their own interests. And these are all things, this is not meant to be about my book, but these happen to be arguments that I take up in more detail in the book, that it doesn't suit the court to strike down the statute or to announce it as unconstitutional, when in fact their practices have always been sort of in, not necessarily inconsistent with, but certainly not the way, they have not acted in the way that a judge would apply a statute to anyone else when they apply, quote unquote, apply that statute to themselves.
It's an extremely spirited opening to Legal Face-Off on WGN+. Many thanks to Louis Ferrelli, professor of law at Stetson University. The book he just mentioned, Disqualifying the High Court, Supreme Court Recusal, and the Constitution. And return guest, Professor Ronald Rotunda, professor of law at Chapman University School of Law. Thank you both for your time here on WGN.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Stocked heavy with guests today, Legal Face-Off on WGN+. Check us out, iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. We go now to the Chief Legal Officer for ABO. He is Josh King, and he joins Rich and Jason now in Chicago. Hello, how are you?
I'm well. How are you guys doing?
Doing great, Josh. Thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off. So tell us what ABO is.
Well, ABO is fundamentally a website that's designed to help people find and connect with the right lawyer. And it's designed for people who don't necessarily know any lawyers, don't necessarily have any friends who are lawyers or friends who know lawyers. So we give them lots of information, including ratings and profiles for just about every lawyer in the country.
So probably the ratings are what a lot of us know ABO for most. You know, I'm a defense lawyer, so I look at my ABO profile pretty often, hoping that someone is rating me. But I think what I see
every day after Googling yourself,
what it seems to be more of in terms of the rating, something that plaintiffs' lawyers like Jason are involved with. Is that true? In terms of the rating,
well,
specifically,
or yeah, no? We've got about 8 million people a month come to the site who are looking for information for lawyers. Most of those people are your retail consumers who are going to be more on the plaintiff side. Those are the defense in-house counsel, the insurance companies, they know how to find a lawyer, so they don't necessarily need to be quite as reliant on ABO as your retail consumers might be. The rating itself, there's actually two ratings. There's the ABO rating, which is that 1 to 10 rating that you're familiar with. That's our rating. That's our editorial rating of you as a lawyer. It's based on your background and your peer endorsements. But there's also the client review rating, and that's the rating, sort of a traditional 1 to 5 star rating that's based on client feedback.
And Josh, as a plaintiff's attorney, how can ABO help me?
Well, as a plaintiff's attorney, again, we're getting in front of like 8 million people a month who are looking for information about their legal problems and looking for a lawyer. And so if you claim your profile on ABO, put your picture on there, put all your biographical information on there so you're sure to get the best possible rating that you can get based on your background with ABO, that's going to put you in front of those 8 million people. And then, listen, we also sell advertising as well. Just like on Google, there's sponsored listings. That allows you to get even more visibility in front of those people who are visiting our site.
So, Josh, we know that there's been some pushback maybe early on from some lawyers who allege that the rating system was unfair, that it was libelous. What was ABO's reaction to that when I know there was a lawsuit, for example. What was the company's reaction to that? And I know, by the way, the lawsuit was ultimately dismissed, I think on the basis that the ratings were an opinion protected by the First Amendment. But from time to time, you must get some feedback from attorneys that, hey, I don't think these ratings are accurate or proper. How do you deal with those?
Yeah, we still get those complaints from time to time. And certainly that lawsuit, which was a class action lawsuit filed the week we launched, listen, I'm not going to lie. It made us a little bit nervous. I mean, you launch a new business, and something like that can make you nervous. But it was also great PR. It kind of exposed what we were doing and the transparency we were bringing to the legal industry. We got a lot of great media coverage for what we were trying to do. And then, yeah, like you mentioned, the case was ultimately dismissed on the pleadings on First Amendment grounds. We've had other lawsuits, similar ones that have been threatened or filed over the years. None of those have ever gotten past the pleadings. There is one that's currently pending in Illinois. Our motion to dismiss is on file, so I expect we'll see the same pattern repeat.
You know, Josh, I actually had an attorney ask me this. He had some pretty defamatory comments put up on Avvo about him. And he's a criminal attorney. It was a situation where the pleading didn't work out as well, and the client was unhappy. What can you do if there is a dispute? I mean, can that attorney reach out to Avvo and try to explain what happened and get that removed and increase the rating?
Yeah, so when it comes to the client reviews, there's a couple of things. We moderate all of the reviews for compliance with our community guidelines, so that's human moderation. But we don't always get that right. So one of the things that person could do is they can write us a letter and say, hey, I'd like you to take a second look at this review. We're happy to do that anytime. I even look at them myself a lot of the time. If that doesn't work, we also have a dispute process. And so if an attorney says, hey, I don't think this review is right, we will actually take the review down and send an email to the reviewer and say, hey, the review's been challenged by the attorney. We only repost the review in that case if the reviewer writes us back and says, yep, I stand behind that review, I affirm it. Because people sometimes leave a review for the wrong attorney, or sometimes they're really heated, and after they've had a little time to reflect, they decide they'd really rather not post that.
We've covered on this show the trends, the sharing economy, the Uberization of a lot of services, certainly the legal services that you've discussed and that your company provides seems to be the trend. There's, you've got Avvo Legal Services. There are other competing companies where consumers, short of actually hiring an attorney, could get their legal questions asked, could get things like wills done. Do you think that this is a trend that will continue? And what does that mean for lawyers like Jason and I?
Yeah, we think it's a huge potential trend. I mean, we've really bet heavily on that with Avvo Legal Services, which are fixed price transparent, limited scope representation. And it's really, our research shows that right now the legal industry has largely given people a choice between doing it themselves entirely or full scope traditional representation, which is just beyond the reach of a lot of people. Even people with means, they look at that and say, you know what, I really can't face the uncertainty that I'm going to get a bill for thousands of dollars from my lawyer. And so they want to grab back a little bit of control. And so that's why we put stuff together so that they know what they're getting and they know what it's going to cost them. And they can do it piece by piece. They can get a piece of advice here. They can have a document review here. They can form a business through this process. They can get a divorce. We think there's a massive latent market out there that's not availing themselves of legal services. And this kind of thing, while it's a bit discomforting to some attorneys, I think ultimately it's going to expand the market if it can be done right.
Yeah, you just made Jason Whiteside die a little inside when you mentioned replacing hiring him with your services, but it certainly seems like a trend that's continuing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I will say that, for plaintiffs' lawyers, particularly in the personal injury area, I don't know that it's ever a replacement for that, because that's a bit of a one-off where you really do need full scope representation for most of those cases.
I agree, Josh. Thank
there's
you.
Not necessarily this happy to throw that in, but there's also not the same financial issues because you've got a contingent fee arrangement in most of those cases.
Josh King is the chief legal officer at Avvo, AVVO.com. Legal easier. I like that. That's a nice little catchphrase. I like that, Josh. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Jason. Take care.
And we close off Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus the same way we always do with the legal grab bag. Eight topics today. We'll see if we get
record
through all eight. We usually drop one or two at the end. But we start in St. Paul on a serious note. The Castile family vowing a lawsuit over some shootings.
Yeah, surprisingly. Oh, was this yours? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, we can both do it. We can share.
No, you're right.
No, Judge Glenda Hatchett has decided to represent the Philando Castile family for the lawsuit that they're going to file against the Minneapolis Police Department for the shooting that occurred this week, which everyone, I'm sure, has heard about, sparked protests and peaceful demonstrations throughout the U.S.
Yeah, not to treat a serious subject less than serious. But yeah, I was a little surprised that they hired a former TV judge, I guess, who's now in private practice. But begs the question, you know, how many other TV judges maybe would you hire if you were?
Well, who did we talk about last time?
Yeah, of course, we had
down
our
in Tennessee. Yeah,
judge. What was his name?
Great judge.
Yeah. It wasn't Wapner.
Judge, I'm disbarred
that.
For bipolar issues.
Yes.
Well, and Judge Hatchett is based out of Atlanta, so this is kind of a stretch. I'm sure Minneapolis has fine attorneys that would be able to represent the family, but obviously, Judge Hatchett will bring a little more publicity to the case, as if there's not enough right now. So, go Judge Hatchett.
Some people wondering, if you have Netflix and you share your password, could you possibly go to jail?
Well, you know, that got a lot of people's attention this past week because there was a ruling against an individual who was prosecuted under a federal statute that really has nothing to do with Netflix. So the answer is no. I mean, possibly down the road, but, you know, everyone freaked out because the dissenting judge in that case said that this could mean, this ruling in this one case could be interpreted to mean that you can't share your password, or if you do, then, you know, companies like Netflix or HBO would come after you. That really doesn't, that's really not what this case stands for. This case involved, again, an individual who left a headhunting firm. He convinced his legal assistant to give him access to her password so he could access proprietary information. And he basically stole some information from his company. And he was prosecuted under this act. And, you know, again, in the dissent, the judge said that maybe in the future this can be used. So a couple things. That's a dissent. A dissent, as we all know, has no precedential value.
Yeah.
And this was a very specific case. They didn't talk in the case about sharing passwords. In the future, if this becomes a problem, will HBO or Netflix go after you? Maybe. In the wake of this, those two companies, the CEOs said, you know, password sharing is not a big problem for us at this point.
Netflix came out and said, we like it. We encourage it. Right. We think it's great. I mean, it just exposes them to more viewership.
Yeah, so much ado about nothing at this point, but maybe down the road.
Fox News Chairman Roger Ailes has been sued for sexual harassment by former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson, and I know that is making Rupert Murdoch all sorts of nervous.
Yeah, you know, rumors about this, but Roger Ailes has gone on, you know, forever. You know, very outspoken guy, very successful guy. I mean, Fox News is the top-rated cable news network. I'm a avid viewer of it. We've tried to get Kimberly Guilfoyle on our air very many times. But, yeah, now a former host, Gretchen Carlson, has said that, in addition, 10 other women have said that, you know, they've been sexually harassed by Roger Ailes over the years. She says that her show was canceled and she, you know, left the station because of that. Of course, Roger Ailes and Fox have said that's not the case at all, that the show was very low rated. And in the wake of this, many prominent Fox News broadcasters have come out in support of Roger Ailes.
Yeah, Bill O'Reilly came out. I mean, just basically said Roger Ailes is a great guy. You know, 95% of everyone, you know, that's coming to contact him would agree that he's great. But yeah, well, it's surprising that they, I mean, typically there's at least some support for the victim who's filing a sexual harassment lawsuit. But yeah, overwhelmingly, there's a lot of support for Roger Ailes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as in many situations, just like we've talked, you know, hundreds of times seemingly on this show about Bill Cosby, you know, after one person came forward, these other women have now come forward. Some of the female Fox broadcasters, Kimberly Guilfoyle, in fact, who we just talked about, have come out and said, hey, listen, if that was the case, Gretchen Carlson, you're not an uneducated person. You went to Stanford. Why wouldn't you have complained earlier? Again, not a atypical reaction to go after the accusers, but this won't go away quickly. The other interesting point is she didn't sue Fox News. She only sued him individually, which is, you know, sort of unusual. Usually you would go after the deep pockets, which in this case Fox News certainly is.
Well, I think there's enough deep pockets with Roger Ailes of whatever she perceives her loss of future some sort of loss of whatever she perceives her loss of future pay would be by having her show X. So I'm sure Roger Ailes can afford a few million dollars, but also too there's insurance policies that are available to cover the acts of employees as well for sexual harassment cases.
Surprise, surprise, autopilot mode from Tesla, putting the company at risk for liability. It crashes because who's really piloting the car when it crashes?
Yeah, I mean, this is a case where my part
alleged victims
obviously represent victims of auto accidents.
Alleged victims.
Well, it's not alleged. I mean, there's an accident and they're injured, so there's no allegation. It's the truth. But we've gone back and forth about when are self-driving cars, you know, going to invade, and when they're going to actually be a large proportion of the population that use them, so accidents are limited. But Tesla came through for us and gave us a nice products liability case in the self-driving cars that have caused significant crashes. One guy died. You have to assume he was decapitated. The whole top of his car was taken off by the semi-trailer. And then there's another accident, too, that is under investigation. So the Highway Transportation Safety Administration has demanded that they want all the black box data and all the information that Tesla stores after the accident so that they can review it, too.
Of course, Tesla, I would imagine their reaction is going to be you probably weren't operating the autopilot correctly, although it's in its early stages. I'm sure there's bugs. You know, not a great time right now in the legal environment to be an auto manufacturer. We've talked on the show before about the $15 billion Volkswagen settlement. There was a $1.5 billion Toyota settlement over the accelerator. So if that happened with Tesla, Tesla's not a big enough company to survive that kind of, you know, settlement or judgment. So there's questions about whether Tesla could survive this coming litigation.
I know their stock price has been, you know, pretty high, but their earnings are actually, they're not there yet. I mean, they're still in the early stages with all their cars. So, yeah, as far as deep pockets go, I mean, a lawsuit of this magnitude could push them towards the edge of bankruptcy.
Well, and even though the Florida guy that you talked about, the person who died, has hired a lawyer, they haven't filed suit yet. And the family said we might not because of how much in love with Tesla, you know, the 40-year-old DeSena was. But, you know, he's no longer around. I'm sure his family is not as in love with Tesla.
I think they love money than Tesla. Exactly. So I'll be surprised if there's not a lawsuit. But I know that the investigation can take a while due to the complications with the product that Tesla put out.
Not too late to get down to Florida, you know, drop some business cards down there.
Just coincidentally going to be there this weekend. Mm-hmm. So see what happens.
The newest vice to make your attention span even worse is a little game you can play on your phone now. It's called Pokemon Go. I don't know if Jason has it. I know Rich probably has it.
Yeah, in the Dungeons and Dragons segment of the show, let's ask Jason Whiteside. I mean, honestly, I no disrespect to the 30-plus million people who are using it, but
how do you have time to use it?
Seriously, like really? The legal implications of it, I mean, there's a couple of, there was one, I think, attempted robbery by people luring, Pokemon Go users into an area. There's also a bunch of police departments that have said, if you trespass while using Pokemon Go, we're going to arrest you.
Yeah, and I mean, there's data breach problems that are coming up, too, because they have access to the accounts. But I'm sure Rich and I don't have any attorneys that are wandering the offices or the streets of Chicago playing Pokemon Go.
That's an instant fireable offense, right, if you get caught at work playing Pokemon Go in a law firm?
It's outrageous enough where, you're just done.
First, you would mock the person incessantly.
Openly in front of everyone else.
My daughter's super into it. I mean, she's 11. That would, maybe you understand an 11-year-old, but you see these, you know, 40-year-olds walking around like our guest Jordan Stone. it's just mind-baffling, mind-boggling.
I don't understand because you have to. I don't have it yet. I'm sure I'll get it at some point because I'm a follower, not a leader. But that being said, you give them your Gmail account, right? So they have access to your emails, and then they have your GPS. Because they follow you around everywhere you go. I don't understand. You're like, you're giving up all your freedoms.
You know, I started to read the article on it, and then I just didn't care enough and put it down. So I have no clue how this whole thing operates. But from what limited amount that I've read, it sounds stupid.
A lawsuit involving Judge Judy over her massive $45 million salary. CBS not happy. They do not want to pay her that much money, but it's in writing.
Yeah, you know, there's a multi-million dollar lawsuit that was filed against CBS. On behalf of against CBS and the host Judge Judy, they are seeking some damages because they say contractually, Judge Judy was supposed to pay them part of the profits that they're earning. But on paper, the show allegedly loses money because they're paying Judge Judy $47 million a year. So there's definitely some accounting discrepancies, and so they're suing because they want a portion of the proceeds that they're entitled to. And Judge Judy continues to make $47 million a year.
That's it. That's like
47 million.
47 million.
There's a spinoff, right? Hot Bench. Sounds pretty sexy.
52 weeks in a year, 47 million.
That's a lot of money. What's the math on that, Sam?
That's just grossed more than 1.7 billion since 1996.
That's crazy.
We move from Judge Judy to Tom Brady. How about that for
this
a transition?
This gig pays almost as much, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's
being
what
the
Sam's
radio judge.
Right? Yeah.
Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's latest attempt to avoid a 4-game suspension for Deflategate. Listen, it's not about deflated footballs right now. It's about Roger Goodell and his power. He was turned down again, so it looks like Brady will continue to miss those first 4 games of the year.
Go away.
Yeah, the Supreme Court. Well, yeah, and the appellate court issued a very lengthy opinion that was about one sentence long, and it said, we're not rehearing it. So the next step is it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. He can apply for, I'm going to screw this word up, but certiorari, and basically have it certified
by the
Supreme
Court. Fancy legal words.
Yeah, I can't speak those Latin words.
Well, the interesting, we talked about Justice Ginsburg, the notorious RBG. Interestingly, she would be the one, she's in control of the Second Circuit, so she'd be the one deciding whether there would be a stay. I mean, what will probably happen?
Hear the case.
Well, they might not hear it, but here's actually the interesting thing. She might, the judge, Brady's attorneys are going to ask the Supreme Court to hear the case, right? The 4-game suspension is coming up pretty soon at the beginning of the season.
Yeah,
September.
It's only like 8 weeks away.
Right. So, what they might do is they might stay the decision or the suspension, they might stay it. Because they're going to decide whether to take it on or not, and the idea behind a stay would be, well, if they agree to take the case and he's already served the suspension, then you know the damage is done.
Right.
So they might stay the 4-game suspension, decide whether to take it or not, and then if they decide not to take the case, then he would serve it at some point after that.
How about backup quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo, who's been in limbo for like 2 years?
Illinois' own, Eastern Illinois.
Rolling Meadows in it, but he doesn't know, am I going to play? He thought Brady was suspended last year.
Like every football coach, you prepare to play. That's just what you do.
Patriots, by the way, still favored to win the Super Bowl in Las Vegas. And we close out legal grab bag with former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who has some new activities in prison.
Well, we've had Len Goodman, his appellate lawyer, on this show before, and there is a hearing, pretty much his last ditch, his last ditch attempt to reduce his 14-year sentence, of which he's served about 4 years, on August 9th before U.S. District Court James Zagel. In advance of that hearing, his attorney, Len Goodman, on Tuesday filed a memo outlining why the court should reduce Blago's sentence. And it was really an interesting memo because he talks about what Blago is doing in prison in Colorado right now and how much of a model citizen he is. He talks about being in a band called the Jailhouse Rockers. Blago is a well-known Elvis aficionado, so they entertain the other inmates with this band. They talk about repairing his relationship with his wife and two daughters. So, you know, we'll see on August 9th. We'll be covering that live from court for Legal Faceoff. But I doubt personally that this will sway the judge. What might sway him is the fact that they dropped 4 counts last year. That might shave off a couple years.
Yeah, that's the only hope that he has.
Yeah, I think he's probably in this for at least another seven or eight years in prison, I mean. And a good way to end a very happy note, ending Legal Faceoff.
Sorry, Blago.
It's okay. What color is his hair now, by the way?
Well, it is white. We had his barber released information about the fact that his hair dye wouldn't last in prison.
For 15 and then there was, years.
Yeah, and then there was pictures of him in jail in the tattered sweatshirt with his white hair. So hard times for
Blago. Do you think he dyes it or puts on a wig when he performs with his band?
Good question for our pending visit to Colorado to interview him for Legal Faceoff.
And you don't get
that
fancy shampoo in prison.
Uh-uh.
At least that's what I've heard. Thank you to our guests, Carl Douglas, Professor Louis Ferrelli, Professor Ronald Rotunda, and Josh King. For Rich and Jason, I am Sam. Thanks to Michael Heidemann as well. We will see you in 2 weeks on WGN Plus. This is Legal Faceoff.
Content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.